So I'm pushing a, I'm going to take a new look at the Loughlin State, which is what you all know and love. And the most striking thing, I guess, for, can you see my pointer anywhere? Oh, it's, you don't see a point, you don't see a pointer on that screen, right? That's why you need the hockey stick. It's not, yeah, okay. The most striking thing for most theorists when they first see the Loughlin State is this beautiful holomorphic structure, which kind of reminds you of complex analysis class and then all kinds of beautiful things from string theory. And usually this has been interpreted, and Loughlin, of course, introduced this wave function and explained its holomorphic character, saying it's a lowest lambda level wave function. And in fact, I'm going to show you that the lowest to characterize the Loughlin state as the lowest lambda level wave function is a complete misinterpretation of its significance. Okay, so one should have probably realized that back at the time, because shortly after the nu equals 1/3 state was found, Loughlin state was found in the second lambda level too. It occurs at 2 1/3. Okay, well that's a slight change from the lowest lambda level, and you can rationalize it. But more recently, it's showing up on lattice systems and partially filled churn insulators, where you start to get completely away from the kind of lambda level interpretation. And in fact, the point will be that the misinterpretation of the Loughlin state as the lowest lambda level wave function has successfully hidden perhaps the physical degrees of freedom of the Loughlin state of the quantum Hall state, which actually have an importance for the way the system responds to the external world. Well, the Loughlin state is somehow a very rigid state. There's nothing you can do with it. There's no variational parameter. The only parameter is Q, and it's given to you. Okay. So let's. As I say, I will probably reveal. I will point out where the geometry is hidden in this state. So if I just go back to the original, the simple explanation that says it's the lowest lambda level state, if that follows from assuming Galilean invariant lambda levels with non-relativistic form, you form the ladder operators for the lambda levels, which in the symmetric gauge basis, we are writing in a Schrodinger formulation, is just a half z plus d by dz star. I've normalized my z's, so the Gaussian factor is a half z star z. And of course, then the lowest lambda level wave functions are just defined by the things which are annihilated by the Loring operator. So trivially, we get the fact they're holomorphic functions times Gaussians. Okay. And so shortly after, I mean, Loughlin produced his state, and it was quickly seen to be the correct state. I mean, it explained why 1/3 and not a half was a strong quantum Hall state. And another thing which happened a bit later was when people noticed that the form of the Loughlin state, its holomorphic part, looked like exactly like the correlators or conformal blocks of conformal field theories. And again, that's a kind of unexplained thing, although people will say, well, it's something to do with edge states or whatever. But this is an empirical observation that is a conformal block. Okay. Now, the question is why the Loughlin state works. I would say that no one ever got around to answering that question. It was known to work. I guess there was probably not much mileage in showing why it worked, because someone had already found it. But basically, Loughlin state was kind of, I think, was accidentally found through three-body calculations on a computer, which was small enough that you could actually see the wave function. And once you saw the wave function, it looked so appealing, it's a clear thing to do. So the usual interpretation of a Loughlin state is that it's a clever state that somehow put zeros of the wave functions on the other particles, and that keeps them apart and lowers the correlation energy. I will actually show you this is a completely empty statement, empty of content. And it's the real reason is not that at all, because we cannot actually have a wave. The bottom line will be that the Loughlin state cannot be described by a wave function. It's not with
a zero state.
A what?
And Loughlin zero state.
Well, okay. So the basic problem with this kind of conventional wisdom is that, among various things, the basic point will be the physics of the fractional Hall effect is the physics of non-commuting guiding centers, or which are really a quantum geometry, and that is just not possible to be described in terms of a Schrodinger wave function. So the question is, what actually is the Loughlin wave function? And of course, I don't want to be rude to our Viennese colleagues, but of course, we had this war between Schrödinger and Heisenberg with their different forms of quantum mechanics. And this came to a peace treaty, which basically said they're equivalent. So the Schrödinger form, a wave function in real space, and the Heisenberg form, an abstract state in Hilbert space, are related by the existence of a basis of all orthonormal states obeying classical locality. And when you have such a basis of states, then we just have the Schrödinger wave function. It's just another way to write the Heisenberg state. But the basic problem is this truce between the two camps requires classical locality. And that's exactly what's lost in the fractional quantum Hall effect. So in the fractional quantum Hall effect, the classical coordinate of the electron, which has, of course, commutes with itself, and you can write Schrödinger wave functions in terms of, decomposes into the sum of a guiding center, which a degree of freedom, which specifies the center of the Landau orbit, and then the radius vector of the Landau orbit, which gets quantized, Landau quantized by the quantization of the kinetic energy. And the Landau quantization basically takes the Landau radius vector out of the picture. Well, you can see, of course, that the classical coordinate is just a sum of two objects, which themselves are independent from each other, but have equal and opposite non-commuting algebras. And of course, the R tilde can be written in terms of the dynamical momenta, but I've chosen to write it as a radius vector. So the problem is that the Landau quantization eliminates this part and simplifies the Hilbert space down to the Hilbert space of guiding centers. And of course, that's the secret that's allowed this problem to be tackled by numerical methods, because the removal of the Landau degree, orbit degrees of freedom, means everything, the Hilbert space becomes extensive in the area of the system. It makes everything practical, and it basically turns the thing into the problem of diagonalizing into something like diagonalizing a lattice, where you've got a finite number of degrees of freedom per unit area. So the residual degrees of freedom, which the problem can be specified in, are non-commutative. This algebra is isomorphic to phase space and obeys an uncertainty principle, and the guiding centers can't be localized within an area less than 2 pi times the magnetic length squared, or this is the magnetic area per flux quantum, the fundamental magnetic area. And of course, in the Hamiltonian describing this system is right, the residual degrees of freedom is completely specified in terms of the guiding centers. And it involves an interaction parameter which derives from a combination of the bare kind of Coulomb interaction between the classical coordinates of the electrons, which you can Fourier transform, and a second term, which are the form factors of the Landau orbits, which, if they're non-relativistic Landau orbits, the nth Landau orbits are Laguerre polynomial, and there's a minus sign missing on the Gaussian there. So basically, this is the statement of the problem. And there's nothing in it, there's no memory in it of the direct memory in it of which Landau level you're in. All the details of which Landau level you're in are included in the form factor, and they don't have to be non-relativistic Landau levels. In fact, Landau levels in the band structure can follow the shape of the bands. So this is just some form factor which describes the trivial part of the problem, the Landau orbits. And this is like contracts often say that the contents of the contract are the entire contract and nothing can be added to it. This is the entire content of the physics. Anything that's not written here or in the commutation relation should not be part of any fundamental description of the fractional quantum Hall effect. So there's F of Q and V of Q by themselves are not properties of it. It's only their products which can be enter in any proper description.
Okay. Duncan, I have one quick question. If you take the Laughlin wave function and you calculate the due to the entanglement entropy in the beginning out of the region, presumably get an area minus log d to view the quantum direction.
Yeah, you get everything you would.
Okay, so what is not contained in the Laughlin wave function? The universal physics of the fact of all.
I'm saying everything. I mean, I'm making a distinction between the Laughlin state and the wave function. It's a state, not a wave function. We'll come back to that. It only has a Heisenberg representation. The Laughlin wave function, the Laughlin state is more basic than its occurrence in the lowest Landau level. Okay. The essence of the Laughlin state is nothing to do with the lowest Landau level. Okay. I'm going to extract its essence here. Okay. So the basic thing, the state of the system can be, of course, written as an unentangled in this limit where the Landau orbit degrees of freedom are much larger and the gaps are much larger than the Coulomb energies, etc. You end up with an unentangled product of the highly non-trivial state of the guiding centers times an absolutely trivial state of the Landau orbits. And this state, this part, of course, contains things like the form factor and the shape of the Landau orbits. But the residual Hamiltonian was completely a problem in this Hilbert space. And so this is the part where we ought to seek any aspect of the fractional Hall effect. If you want to now translate it back, you can, of course, choose a Landau form factor of your choosing, depending where it's graphene or whatever, or different kinds of band structures, and of course convert it back. But everything has to be found in that part. Okay. And so this is a statement of the problem as before. And of course, this actually is essentially follows what Cohn's calls a quantum geometry, because it contains what he refers to as a triple, which here is this algebra, the Gervin-McDonald Platzman algebra, the representation of the algebra, which tells you whether it's fermions and bosons and particles, and then the Hamiltonian, which is the unitary evolution operator. Okay. And so let's look at that. So we're starting from this point. So given the guiding centers, we can construct a set of Landau operators, and these are constructed by a Kähler form, basically, which is a choice of a complex structure. And what I'm doing here, I'm defining this abstractly because the conventional form has been to choose the complex structure based on the shape of the Landau orbits, and that's the incorrect assumption. So I want to set up a set of Landau operators within my guiding center space. I basically have to specify a Euclidean metric, and then I form this form, and then the Landau operators, which obey the commutation relation, are just formed by the product of the coordinates with these complex vectors. Okay, and so the set of Landau operators are defined by the choice of a metric, which is actually given by contracting a more primitive object, the generators of area preserving linear deformations, with a particular choice of metric. Okay. And the new insight is that the choice of this metric so far is arbitrary until I start to discuss the nature of the interactions. Previous work has always, without the slightest amount of thought, has immediately chosen the metric to be the same, the metric given by the shape of the Landau orbits. Okay. But in fact, there are two separate geometrical degrees of freedom in this problem. One is the shape of the Landau orbit, which is reflected by the form factor. The other is the shape of the equipotentials around a point charge. One derives from the effective mass tensor. The other derives from the dielectric tensor of the medium. If I actually tilt the magnetic field a bit, I modify the shape of the Landau orbits, but I don't do anything to the dielectric tensor. So it's just so you can, of course, choose the superficially nice form of choosing a rotational invariance about the normal to the system, in which case both shapes are the same. And that's, of course, what's implicitly been done. But actually, it neglects the fact that one of these degrees of freedom is a dynamical variable that can fluctuate. And the other one isn't. Okay, so the metric will turn out to be the hidden variational parameter Laughlin state. And just as with, if you look at mean field states, you can find the effective low energy degrees of freedom of an ordered state by looking at local spacetime fluctuations of the order parameter, local spacetime fluctuations of the metric about the one that minimizes the energy is actually the physics of the Laughlin state. So in the Laughlin wave function, I chose my Landau orbits to be circles, so the conventional choice was just to choose 1-1 as the identity matrix as the metric. I'm not doing that. So this is the basis of the states of this Landau operators. The conventional ones will just, of course, have a set of circles mirroring the congruent with the Landau orbits, and these will be identified as angular momentum 1. In fact, if you look at the case, this should be a half, 3/2, 5/2, 7/2, because the expression for the angular momentum contains a zero-point term. And this would be the form for a more general form. Now, of course, I've done nothing to violate the condition. If I now project this put this into the lowest lambda level and give a wave function description, this basis is the central state of this basis is just the conventional Gaussian. The central state of this basis is also a holomorphic function times a Gaussian. The holomorphic function is an exponential, and it's parameterized by the shift. So this is still a Gaussian, but it's no longer Gaussian in both directions. It was the same with the same principle, the same axes in both directions. So in the original Schrodinger scheme, the lowest Landau level language, these were the set of operators that move you between the Landau levels. These are the set of operators that move you between this onion ring of shell of states on the guiding center basis, the previous slide, these guys. And I've written Z bar and the Z bar star. And the general relation that's required between these two things is only that Z bar is a linear combination of Z star and Z, which is given by a Bogoliubov transformation. So alpha squared has minus beta squared is equal to 1. The original Laughlin wave function language just puts beta equals to 0, so z bar is equal to z star. So the message here is partly that z bar is not necessarily equal to z star. And of course, in the original form, the action of the lowering operators is the raising operators on a lowest Landau level state is just to multiply the holomorphic function by, I missed out the f here, by z times f. So that immediately gives us how we can convert the Laughlin wave function from a Landau level basis dependent form to an intrinsic form that doesn't depend on any choice of Landau level. So these are just omega times a. These are just the raising operators of that basis. So these are kind of ai dagger minus aj dagger to the q, acting on a vacuum state which is annihilated by the lowering operators. Okay. So this is the Laughlin state in its abstract Heisenberg form. And of course, this state, which is parameterized by a continuous function of the geometry G, the determinant one metric, is also the exact zero energy eigenstate of a particular choice of interaction potential, the pseudo-potential form, which itself depends on the metric. So if I choose the interaction potential with a particular choice of metric, the Laughlin state with the same metric will be its exact ground state. And if I choose a Laughlin state with a slightly different metric, that'll have a finite energy, which will be a quadratic function of the metric, because it'll be minimized at zero energy when the metric of the wave function coincides with the metric of the special potential. So we see that we actually have to, this is now a variational parameter, and we have to choose it to do as best as we can for the interaction. And this particular interaction, we can choose this G equal to that G and get the thing to be exactly zero energy and be an exact ground state. For the Coulomb potential, we can still use the Laughlin state as a variational state. And if we have rotational invariance around the normal to the plane, then the metric will naturally be minimized when it takes that. But if the two geometries are non-congruent, the Coulomb interaction and the form factors don't kind of have the same symmetry, there'll be some intermediate metric between the two that where the Laughlin state minimizes the energy. So I'd like to now just interpret what exactly the Laughlin wave function is. This is now a Heisenberg form, and so a lot of work in the Laughlin state has involved complex polynomials and things which are functions of a complex variable. So the question is, what exactly are those things? Okay. Well, let's go back to the closest thing to a classical state we can have with these non-commuting coordinates are the coherent states. Now, the coherent states have a choice in them, the coherent state is the central state of this basis here. And so actually, I have to choose a coherent state, I have to choose a geometry for a basis of coherent states. But once I've chosen the geometry, then I can choose a basis of coherent states which are centered on the point Z rather than the origin. And this is, of course, an overcomplete, non-orthogonal overcomplete basis of states to describe the system. And so they have an overlap between them, which is pretty easy to evaluate. It's just in terms of z-bar, the coordinate describing the geometry of the correlation hole of Laughlin state. It's given by this. Now, if I'm dealing with a non-orthogonal basis, which is overcomplete, this overlap matrix is a positive but not positive definite Hermitian matrix, which will have lots and lots of zero modes. In fact, because it's infinitely overcomplete, there'll be infinite set of zero modes. So the way you deal with something like that is to, one way to deal with it, rather than Schmidt orthogonalization or something, is just to seek out the non-zero eigenvalues of the overlap matrix. And those are, and that will give you a linearly independent orthonormal basis of states, which you can describe everything in. So this is now not a matrix, but a kernel of integral operator, because Z is a continuous variable, not a matrix variable. But basically, here's the eigenvalue equation we have to solve. And we're interested in non-null eigenstates of that thing. The non-null eigenstates of this thing turn out to be degenerate, so they all have lambda equals 1. And ta-da, they're all given by holomorphic functions times a Gaussian of z bar star. So if I choose this geometry to match the original Laughlin form, where z bar is equal to z star, these happen to look exactly like lowest lambda level wave functions. But there is nothing in this derivation that made any reference to whatever lambda level you're in, and it's a property of the quantum geometry, yeah.
Why are you asking what are the eigenstates with lambda equal to 1?
I'm asking what are the eigenstates with lambda not equal to 0.
Right.
All the non-zero eigenstates. Well, that's how you create
an... That's fine, but why do you...
I know, I'm telling you, they turn out to all have lambda equals 1.
Oh, I see.
They're all degenerate, so there's no particular holomorphic function that's... They're all equivalent. This is the spectrum of this thing is completely... It's got this set of... The holomorphic functions are eigenvalue 1, everything else is eigenvalue 0. Okay?
So it's a projective.
What?
It's a projective.
It's the eigenstates of the overlap matrix, which I'm going to call a geometry.
But this overlap matrix is a projective. Has eigenvalues 1 or 0?
No, not generally.
Well, no, but in this particular case, I only say that the only lambdas...
Okay, I suppose for this particular case, if this integral was over a set of discrete points, the overlap matrix is not generically a projector.
Right, but in this case, I thought you were saying that the only...
Okay, in that case, it is a projection, as a particular case, okay. In general, the overlap matrix has some set of eigenvalues in it. The basic thing is the distinction between the zero eigenvalues, which you throw away, and the other ones, which you don't. So we see where the holomorphic functions come from. This, nothing in this made any reference to what lambda level you're in or what any kind of structure of the lambda level. So finally, we see what the true origin of holomorphic functions in the fractional Hall effect is, coming from the geometry of non-commuting, or geometry of the basis set of states, which come from the non-commuting geometry. And in fact, you can see an immediate parallel now with Chern insulators and flat band models. Because again, if we project a Chern insulator, if we have a lattice and we project every orbital into a given band, into one band of the Chern insulator, if there's, for example, two orbitals per unit cell, I will, of course, have a vastly overcomplete basis. And in fact, the orbitals projected back onto a given lattice site and then raised back to unit strength, they will, of course, have had to spread out to the neighboring lattice sites, because I've got two lattice sites in each unit cell and only one independent state per unit cell. So once you view this, you see that the structure and fishing out the properties, the Laughlin Hamiltonian and also the Chern lattice problems can actually be written in a kind of gauge invariant language, where the Hamiltonian consists only of things that don't move the particles around. So they're completely gauge invariant, written in terms of occupation numbers. But they're occupation numbers of non-orthogonal states. So instead of the dynamics of the particles coming from hopping with perhaps coupled to gauge fields, et cetera, from lattice sites to lattice sites that obey classical locality, they're actually coming from the fact that if the orbital's on this site, it's got some amplitude given by the overlap matrix to be on the neighboring sites. So the overlap matrix, in that language, stitches together a set of independent orbitals and imposes the geometry and stitches them together into a quantum manifold. Okay. So in fact, looking at this, you start to understand why you can see it on, see the Laughlin state on lattices. The key idea is that the key connection is that they have the similar kind of geometric structure overlap factors. Okay. So when I now write the Laughlin state out in this coherent state basis, of course, that means we could use the holomorphic. We know that we only need to use holomorphic functions in here. And in fact, of course, the Laughlin state, in terms of the coherent state basis, the coherent state amplitude is what was previously referred to as the Laughlin wave function. This is technically not a wave function because this is not an orthonormal basis of states. This is a coherent state amplitude. So the Laughlin wave functions is not a wave function, it's a coherent state amplitude. That was the message. So the metric itself is a physical degree of freedom. As I said, it characterizes the shape of the correlation hole in the Laughlin state. And in fact, the Laughlin state can be interpreted in one way as describing a condensate of composite bosons in which are made by attaching Q flux quanta, which in this language is orbitals, to the particles. And in general, we can a composite boson is formed by attaching Q flux quanta to P particles. And the new feature here is that there is a geometric component to flux attachment, which is the shape of the flux attachment. It's not just an abstract thing of I glue so many fluxes or so many degrees of so many orbitals to a particle. It's what shape I glue them into to the particle. So if I look at the one-third Laughlin state, the key feature of the pseudopotential Hamiltonian and the Laughlin state itself is that if I choose a basis of this ring of shell of states centered at a point with the right geometry, the right shape specified by the metric, and I find that the central orbital is occupied, the Laughlin state guarantees that the next two orbitals are always empty, okay, of the right shape. And so you can actually understand the formation of this as a stable structure, which of course is an exact structure in the Hamiltonian for which Laughlin is exact, but is a structure that leads to the quantum Hall effect. Essentially, it's something like an atomic structure. We'll see it gets more like an atomic structure when we go to more than one electron. But basically, we've got an exclusion region. The basic physics is kind of like Hubbard model physics, where a particle excludes other particles from some region. In this case, there's no underlying lattice, so it's not a simple thing that I don't allow anyone else to be on my lattice site. It's a little region around me. And of course, inside this little hole, the other electrons in the fluid outside will repel it. So in fact, instead of an atom having attraction to a singular potential with a nucleus at the center, they're being repelled from the other part. It's a bit like what Bastrand was trying to describe for the quantum solid, sitting where the particle sits in a kind of self-traps in its own vacancy, right? So the Laughlin state is, you have a little potential and well here, and it's sitting in, an electron is sitting in the lower state, and this thing has a spin, because what we actually have to do is that the effective background gets subtracted off. So if I fill the thing up, I would get one in the first orbital, nothing in the second orbital, and those would add up to angular momentum 1/2, because it's 1/2, 3/2, 5/2. When you subtract off the background, which would be 1/3 in each orbital, relative to the background, it's actually a spin of -1. And the spin is the spin, which is a reinterpretation of what people have called the shift in the past, is the fundamental geometric degree of freedom of this.
In the wave function you wrote down, the metric appears as a global object.
Yeah, the Laughlin state has a completely flat metric. The Laughlin state is rigid. And of course, conformal field theory, which is based on, is rigid too. Conformal field theory is like special relativity. There is a fixed metric, and it's not allowed to vary. Okay? And of the metric, of course, is what defines angles between things, and conformal transformations preserve angles. So it's
the metric. Wave function that you write down, is it elevated to a local degree of
freedom? It is indeed, but not so far. The 2/5 state, for example, is something similar. In this language, it's this kind of droplet, and you fill the lowest two. And in fact, the so-called Jane sequence is essentially an atomic sequence where you fill the levels up, like by the Pauli principle, in the droplet. Okay. So 2/5 state has a much larger spin. The spin gets bigger and bigger as I go up the sequence. And the size of the spin will actually, I'll show, makes the system floppier and floppier, and the gaps weaker and weaker. In fact, if I go to the second Landau level, the potential is weaker because the form factors are different in the second Landau level. and it's quite likely that the two-fifth state, the standard one, doesn't form, because if there's a here, the, if this potential is strong, the second electron will go in the second orbital, even though it doesn't like to be too close to the first one. But if potential is weaker, the presence of the first electron will kind of cause like a Mexican hat. At some point, it's better to put the second electron in the third orbital. And I believe C. Steinman's Gaffneyan state is a state where there's a complete exact degeneracy between putting the two-fifth, making the two-fifth state by putting electron in the second and third orbital. And you can see that in the patterns that correspond to the Jack polynomial motifs that it has. Okay, so the composite particle behaves as a neutral particle because of the Berry phase, which really arises from, as its exclusion zone moves around, it pushes the other particles out of the way, and that adds up to cancel the Bonar-Hronov. It's got a, it has to behave as a boson, whereas its statistical spin has to cancel. So you have these kind of rules. Of course, in the standard, this is the odd denominator rule, although in the odd denominator rule, people believe that P and Q had to be relative primes, which is not true. They can actually have a common factor of 2, so P is 2 and Q is 4 for the Moore-Reed state. And I guess this probably gives what Ashwin was talking about for the, this rule probably also explains the fact that the boson, the bosons with Q equals 1 had to have an, had to have a, an even value of P. So the shape of the composite boson is determined by minimizing the sum of the correlation energy and the background potential energy. So if there's no background potential, then the metric will be, and the ground state will be flat. And the charge density will be uniform. But if there's a background density, the potential, the metric will actually vary to give it, will can vary with space to give a charge density fluctuation. I don't have time to give you the derivation, but the result is that the electric charge density ends up being proportional with the spin to the Gaussian curvature of the metric. And if you look carefully, this term, I had some time and difficulty in getting this, but now I have it. This term comes from a variation of the second moment of the charge distribution. And this term comes from so this would, this is all you'd get if the shape was changing, but the density of the centers was unchanged. But there's another effect where the Berry, where as you go around, if you go, if you're changing your shape as you go around the loop, there's a Berry curvature associated with that. And the Berry curvature gives you that extra term to add up to give you the Gaussian, the full Gaussian curvature formula.
Can I ask a question here? So for the 5-half Moore-Reed state, do you get a positive curvature metric or do you get a negative curvature metric?
Sorry, the metric is flat, always in a uniform state. The curvature metric arises through the adaptation to a background potential. So the metric of the uniform system is flat. But because curvature of the metric, so if the, there's going to be some value of the metric which minimizes the correlation energy, so if all you had to minimize was a translation invariant correlation energy, then you'd have a completely flat ground metric. But if you have to minimize the sum of the correlation energy plus a potential, as in, for example, near the edge of a sample, you can actually just even see from it, here near the edge of this sample, I've got a gradient of the electric field. So most of the time, people are focused on the electric field at the boundary. But this actually shows you the most important thing at the boundary is the gradient of the electric field, not the electric field itself. Okay. So the, this case, there's this, this electric field is wanting to squeeze the droplet, the boson in that direction. So this, of course, this gives rise to differential flow velocities in the parallel to the boundary, and so you get this deformation along the directions of the flow lines. But basically, because this has Gaussian curvature, this has positive Gaussian, this allows the density to be pushed inwards exactly as the boundary would want to do it. And this generates a dipole moment which reacts back with the electric gradient of the electric field to resist the force that's pushing you. Okay? And in fact, this is a Hall viscosity term, because the Hall viscosity term arises when you have a gradient. Say I have a gradient of the velocity in y direction as a function of x. The viscosity term is x is like xxxy, three, you know. And so this will correspond to a current of momentum, x component momentum in the x direction, which is exactly a force, right? So the whole viscosity is written in terms of the metric and the spin, and it also involves the, this is a spin per, this is the spin of the composite boson, and Q is the flux of the composite boson. Okay. So whole viscosity determines the dipole moment per unit length at the edge, And you can also see it, read it off from the angular momentum of a droplet. If there's n bar composite bosons, a half pq is the statistical or conformal spin of the boson, and the s is the additional factor. This is proportional to n squared, just like, you know, conformal spins bro as you double it, it goes up by four, right? And this is the geometric part, which is linear. So previously, a part of this is called the shift. I separated out what was called the shift before into geometric spins associated with the guiding centers, and there's an equivalent geometric spin associated with the Landau orbits. But the Landau orbits generally are not going to change their shape and do interesting collective things. And the Landau orbit part is the Avron, Seiler, and Zograph component. And of course, the momentum is proportional to a dipole moment. So actually, you can first of all look at the dipole moments. And so actually, this gives you a kind of, if you take an ideal Laughlin state, you'll find a universal dipole moment related to the shift. This is a way you, and this could be viewed as, it gives you, there was a term that was extensive in the angular momentum, which comes from, you can think of it as a dipole moment per unit length. Okay. Now if I look at, now get to the entanglement finally. So if I want to interpret the perimeter or the area or the perimeter law of entanglement, which naturally comes when I do a cut, of course, the geometry of entanglement is really a count of the intrinsic degrees of freedom per unit area of the surface, right? This is per unit length. So here, the metric naturally shows up because it actually tells you what the things like the conformal field theory don't, what the actual cutoff in a given direction is. So the fluid has a certain intrinsic shape to it, the correlation holes, and so the number of correlation holes I cut per unit length actually is the way to measure the length in an intrinsic way, and that's what shows up in entanglement entropy and momentum polarization.
Is it fair to say that the guiding center of physics is enslaved?
No, the guiding center of physics is all the physics you have.
Oh, I mean, I meant the other way around, sorry.
It's gone.
It's gone, it's enslaved.
I'm not interested in the S orbitals of uranium if I'm studying F bands, right? It's gone. It's a degree of freedom that's not, I mean, it's
but
not.
What if you took, Duncan, a finite energy density state in the last time level?
Sorry?
What if you took a finite energy density state in the last time level?
Yeah.
Would this feature still be true?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But if you weren't in the last time level, it wouldn't necessarily be true.
There's no difference between if I'm at temperature such that I'm not exciting, temperature small compared to the gap, and all the I'm only interested in the in thermally excitations of the degrees of freedom of the fractional hole, which is then there's nothing, the others are quenched. Of course, they will show up exponentially. There'll be, of course, you'll start to excite the other degrees of freedom. This is the limit where
the thermally equilibrates. But you're saying it's not these degrees that are not separately thermally equilibrated.
The others are just quenched. Okay, so this is a so I'm at, because of this whole thing that the Landau degrees of freedom, the wave function, are really irrelevant to the quantum Hall effect. I'm a kind of not a great fan of the so-called application of so-called real space cuts in the quantum in the fractional quantum Hall effect for entanglement. So I know people have argued that the real space cut, you know, they've argued, well, there must be something wrong. It doesn't properly describe the nu equals one state, blah, blah, blah. But actually, doing the real space cut here is equivalent to someone saying, you're cutting your Hubbard model up by lattice size, but those atoms are really little atoms. They're S orbitals, and you've got to cut them. And your cut will actually chop off bits of the orbitals of your atoms and things. So if you move the boundary, this boundary is a little bit close to your atoms, or you try to move it, your atom will spread out, and of course the lattice site is not a local object either, right? So locality is somewhere at the Planck scale. There's no locality is fuzzy anyway, so. You have to fuzz your locality somewhere, and there's no merit, I believe, in the so-called real space cuts here. So this is orbital entanglement spectrum, which is much easier to do. Instead of taking every state and turning it into 2 to the n states, you've got a clean spectrum with a lot of structure. And so I was mainly interested in this form the term proportional to the area. So I now multiply this by the length to get the momentum. This actually looks at the momentum in the entanglement spectrum at temperature 1, or fictitious temperature 1, compared to the vacuum value. And the leading term is just the Hall viscosity, which is now a proper metric object with indices dot producted with the length along the length of the boundary around the cylinder. And the terms which I guess Xiaoying and the other group in the Berkeley group were looking at also were interested in these terms here, the terms which are order one in this expansion, next terms being order one over L squared. Of course, you pick up, again, how you chop these cylinders, you chop them in different sectors, so you pick up the Virasoro level sector of the sector, which you can determine just by inspection of the root configuration of the cut. But more interesting, the stuff that's related to what happens when you heat the thing up, you have the conformal. There are two basic anomalies in this system, the conformal anomaly associated with heat transport and the chiral anomaly associated with charge transport. And they apparently enter in this form. This is at least what one sees. We've done this numerically for Laughlin states, and it looks like this is the right formula because this is invariant on the particle hole transformations. You can see that for mu equals 1, there's nothing in my spectrum, but I've got nothing here either. Because for nu equals one, the whole viscosity is zero. So the guiding center part of the whole viscosity is zero. There's only one vacuum, so the H is zero. And C is equal to one, and nu is equal to one, so it cancels. So this is completely consistent with the thing. And this is a much more convenient way to do things than this awful method of taking every level, introducing a completely arbitrary form factor for your guiding set, for your lambda orbits, and kind of doing a convolution with a function that's not part of the problem, right? So you can the physics is all in the guiding centers, and you can find everything you want in the guiding centers. So actually, this was just something showing. This was Nicholas Regno's data we took, and he has some kind of cutoff parameter that says how many levels of the matrix product state you keep, and doing it by exact diagonalization, we got this number pretty good down to here. But he can go a bit further, and you can see that as the truncation level gets bigger, you're basically this is the leading parts of this momentum polarization formula as a function of size, and you can see it nicely fits
what is the dashed line?
The dashed line is the one with the dashed line is that yeah, plus one. That.
Oh, but I mean, what is that state you're showing?
This is nu equals our third Laughlin state.
All
right. Okay. So 136 is the, so it's 120. Let's see, it's 1/24 times 1 minus a third, right? Yeah, whatever. I think it should be 136. Okay, so other consequences very quickly. The long wavelength limit of the GMP mode is a graviton. I'll show you a picture. The Q to the fourth behavior of the guiding structure center turns out to be due to the zero-point fluctuations of the metric, because the components of the metric, when you quantize them, don't their fluctuations don't commute, but their determinant is like the Casimir of the algebra, so the density itself doesn't change. And the conformal field theory with a fixed metric, it has a fixed metric, and putting this stuff in is like extending special relativity to general relativity, and I haven't got time to go through this kind of stuff. But somewhere there was a nice picture. I'm not sure if I have it there or not. Okay. I had a nice picture somewhere, but I guess this got left out of the spectrum. This is actually just showing some issues that the Gaussian curvature, trying to fit the Gaussian curvature of things. And this is the same. Okay. There's some kind of general relativity-like things you put in. Now this state has a geometric distortion energy, and there's a set of Euler equations. And basically, there's the same kind of action. It looks very much like the Wen and Zi action of 1992, except there they had a curvature coming from an external, putting things on the surface of a sphere. Here it couples to, Gaussian curvature doesn't really care where it comes from, right? So their curvature was extrinsic. This is a kind of intrinsic curvature, but the way it couples to everything is actually identical. The only thing is now you have to add a Hamiltonian, an energy part to the action, which actually tells you how the energy changes. So now you have energy flow and momentum flow intrinsic by deformation by geometric dynamics on the state. Okay, thank you.